Well, one of the joys of the winter season, and I'll call it a joy, is that as we drive down the highway, we lift this mist of road dirt and crud, and it ends up all over the back windshield of our car. So every time you look back trying to find out if anybody's behind you, just keep in mind the prophecy in 1 Corinthians 13 that we see through a glass darkly. Truer words were never spoken. However, as we get closer to the time that the various biblical prophecies describe, our view becomes clearer and clearer. And I think that's appropriate with any prophecy we might want to consider, that in time, as the events come upon us, we can see very much more clearly than we could in times past. There were many prophecies that we considered in the past and wove them into our various scenarios, one of which is the one in Isaiah chapter 3 that says, "Children are their oppressors and women rule over them." Another one is, "The stranger that is within your gates shall get up above you very high," in Exodus chapter 20. When we first began considering that prophecy, it was more in the context of the riots that were taking place in various cities back in the 60s. When we consider that prophecy today, we can get a very different picture, because things have come into being that weren't the circumstance then. The stranger that is within your gates is different than what we might have thought back then. Another prophecy in Haggai, chapter 1, verse 6, talks about us putting our money in bags with holes. Now that one, I suppose, has significance almost any time, but especially today, when you consider what is happening. There's a couple of other prophecies. One is in Leviticus 26, where God says, "I will break the pride of your power." Again, years ago, we thought of that prophecy in perhaps a different context than we might today, considering more recent developments. And that particular prophecy is going to factor into the message that I want to bring to you today. Another one is in Revelation 13, where the beast power says, "Who is able to make war with him?" There is a prophecy in the 11th chapter of Daniel, it's the entire chapter, that is extraordinary on a number of counts. In fact, it is so extraordinary that the probabilities of it having been a prophecy, the odds against it, are astronomical. Scholars don't believe that this chapter was written when it was claimed to have been written, approximately 200 years before the time of Alexander the Great. He was describing events that were some 400 years into the future. Because Daniel chapter 11 is so specific, point after point after point has been proven historically to be so astoundingly accurate that logically a Bible scholar would be inclined to say this could not have been written in advance. However, Jesus Christ referred to this particular chapter in Matthew 24, and another account of it is given in Mark 13, where he affirmed the validity of this prophecy. Now, it's interesting when we consider that at the time that he said what he said, that this was already almost 200 years in arrears. It had already been completely fulfilled. Daniel 11, from beginning to end, is already fulfilled. And the final stage of it was fulfilled some 160 years B.C. But he told us something that we might not otherwise understand. Just reading Daniel 11, we would have no reason to believe that it was prophetic, because it is, in fact, historic. It is all completed. If he hadn't said what he said, we would have no reason to be looking at this chapter as a prophecy also. In other words, it has a historic fulfillment, but it also has a future fulfillment. We wouldn't have known that, except where he said in Matthew 24, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, he was referring to this particular passage of Scripture, because this is the only place. Let's go there. Matthew 24, 15. I want to read exactly the way it's worded, because he is, in effect, telling us specifically to watch for certain events. I'll start in verse 14. He said, "And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. When you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand. Then let them which be in Judea flee unto the mountains." Not only is he telling us to consider this passage in Daniel chapter 11, but he is also asking us to understand it. And why? Because it's relevant. Because it's important. We are given a barometer with which to see the end time coming. It is a broad view picture where we can look at world events and we can understand what is happening and what is going to happen next. And we can understand, more importantly, where we are in the time context as we approach the time of the end. Daniel 11 gives us a series of sequential developments. And personally, I believe that it is so specific and so accurate in its first half that we will have no doubt about the second half. Because it's the second half that has applicability to the modern age. So we shouldn't dismiss this prophecy lightly. Jesus Christ specifically brought us into an awareness of something important, that this prophecy has a dual application. It's relevant in its own day, but it also pictures the events of the future. Now, I'm going to go through chapter 11, but I want to do so very briefly. And for the historic portions of it, I'm going to breeze through it with just the most highest highlights. We could go through this in great detail because there is a lot of historical proof of the accuracy. But I'll just touch on some of the highlights until we get down to the part that I really want to focus on. But in Daniel chapter 11, it begins, "And I also, in the first year of Darius the Mede, even I stood to confirm and to strengthen him. And now I will show you the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all. And by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all nations." Stir up all against the realm of Grecia. Now these three kings were Cyrus, Cambyses, and Darius, mentioned there in verse 1. The fourth, was Xerxes, who invaded Greece, but was defeated at Salamis in 480 B.C. The book of Daniel was written about 570 B.C. That's earlier, about 90 years, and completed about 540 B.C. The Persian Empire, of course, was the second of those four images, or those four representations of the image that you see in Daniel chapter 2, describing the four world empires from the time of Babylon to the end. But the Persian Empire was the second. And it conquered Babylon, which was the first. Daniel lived into the early years of the Persian Empire's ascendancy. The Babylonian Empire's ascendancy lasted less than a century. The Persian Empire lasted 2 centuries. But with that, we come into the section of prophecy that begins with Alexander the Great. The beginning of the Greco-Macedonian Empire, which was the third image. Verse 3, "And a mighty king shall stand up, that shall rule with great dominion, and do according to his will." And this is referring to Alexander the Great, who campaigned from 336 B.C. to 323 B.C. But his empire lasted for 185 years. However, he was in control of it only for the first dozen years or so during his military campaigns, after which he died rather suddenly. "And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken," and that's where he fell, "and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven," and not to his posterity, these weren't his descendants who took the kingdom, "nor according to his dominion which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up even for others besides those." Simple language, Alexander's kingdom was divided among his four generals, none of which were his physical descendants. "And the king of the south shall be strong, and one of his princes, and he shall become strong above him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion." Now, of these four generals who took over the Alexander's empire, two of them became the prominent ones, and they are the two that are referred to throughout the rest of this prophecy: the king of the south, which was the stronger originally, and the king of the north. The Ptolemies ruled Egypt, the Seleucids ruled Asia Minor. In verse 6, "And in the end of years they shall join themselves together, for the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement, but he shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand for his arm, for he shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times." This is referring to Berenice, the daughter of Ptolemy II, who married Antiochus II, and she was murdered. "But out of the branch of her roots shall one stand up in his estates, which shall come with an army, and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north, and he shall deal against them and shall prevail." And this was Ptolemy III, the brother of Berenice, who invaded Syria and won a great victory. The details in this passage are extremely accurate. Verse 8, "And he shall also carry captives into Egypt, their gods with their princes and with their precious vessels of silver and gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. So the king of the south shall come into his kingdom and shall return into his own land. But his sons shall be stirred up, and he shall assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overflow and pass through them. Then shall he return and be stirred up even to his fortress. And the king of the south shall be moved with choler, and shall come forth and fight it with him, even with the king of the north. And he shall set forth a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given to his hand." And this is referring to Ptolemy the IV, defeating Antiochus III with great loss at the Battle of Raphia in 217 B.C. "And when he had taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up, and he shall cast down many 10,000s, but he shall not be strengthened by it." The victory didn't profit him all that much. "For the king of the north shall return, and shall set forth a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come after certain years with a great army and with much riches." This is referring to Antiochus III returning after 14 years later with a great army, and at that time he was victorious. Verse 14, and in those times there shall be many stand up against the king of the south. Also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision, but they shall fall. So the king of the north shall come and cast up a mountain, shall take the most fenced cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people. Neither shall there be any strength to withstand. But he that comes against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him. And he shall stand in the glorious land, which by his hand shall be consumed. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him. And thus shall he do. And he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither before him. And this is where Antiochus gave his daughter to marry Ptolemy V, attempting to gain control over Egypt. But she sided with her husband against her father. The accuracy is astounding. Verse 18, after this shall he turn his face unto the isles and shall take many, but a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. Without his own reproach, he shall cause it to turn upon him. Then shall he turn his face toward the fort of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. This was a later invasion of Asia Minor in Greece, which was defeated by the Romans, and he was slain when he returned back home. Now, there are people who have looked at this prophecy and said, well, yeah, this is good history, but was it ever prophecy? Jesus Christ affirmed the fact that this prophecy not only is accurate, but that we should regard it seriously. Now, all of this up to this point is history. And those who aren't particularly interested in history would probably find it rather dull. Except for the fact that it lays the foundation to tell us that Bible prophecy is accurate, that it can be depended upon, that it should be taken seriously. Now, I mentioned earlier that there is a point in time where this prophecy backs up and overlays on the modern era. Up to this point, verses 19 or so, this is strictly historic. We shouldn't be looking in this area for any future fulfillment. That wasn't what Christ was referring to. He made reference to the point where the abomination of desolation and the individual who does that comes on scene. That's who we need to be looking for, and it's at that point where this prophecy takes on its dual application and becomes relevant to the modern era. Exactly where that transition takes place, I don't know for sure. It could be about in verse 20, or it could be as late as verse 27. Somewhere in that time frame, the prophecy begins to fade from one scene and fade into another. But it's the second scene that is the point of this message today. Most of what has occurred up to this point may be interesting to a scholar. I don't know that it's all that interesting to us, except to establish the validity, the accuracy of the book of Daniel and this prophecy in particular. Those who have studied this next portion, the second portion, have noticed that it falls basically into three parts. Verses 21 and 22 reflect the rise of this end time person, or actually also the original person it was referring to, which is Antiochus Epiphanes, who did some amazing things in Israel back in his time. But verses 21 and 2 reflect his rise. Verses 23 to 31 refer to that period of time of making the covenant to the setting up of the abomination of desolation. in verses 32 to 45, his career of blasphemy to the time of his destruction. So exactly where the second overlay begins and fades, one, the old fades out and the new portion fades into view, we can't exactly say. But I'd like to present to you some possibilities. Some of this may be speculative, and if you feel you need to disagree, feel free to do so. I'm just saying we see through a glass darkly. But as we get closer to the time, I expect we will see more clearly. But so long as we've got the framework of this message in our mind, I think we'll see the reality as reality comes upon us. But somewhere, we know for sure that by the time we get to that verse, in verse 31, where he makes reference to the abomination that maketh desolate, by that time we know that we are in the modern application of this prophecy. We have Christ's own words for it. He told us to look at this, and he asked us to understand it. So we ought to make the effort to do so. I'm going to go ahead and speculate and say that the overlay between the ancient version or the ancient fulfillment and the modern application begins about verse 20. That's what seems to me. So let's read it with that thought in mind. In verse 20, "Then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom, but within a few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle." Now, in the modern context, we can understand a person who would be known as a raiser of taxes. With the massive debts that governments are racking up these days, and it's not just this country, Europe is in a similar circumstance, and many other nations are as well. A raiser of taxes is not somebody hard to imagine coming along and someone being famous for that. But after there is this person, we find that he doesn't live very long. He's destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. Does that suggest a political destruction? That's not difficult to picture. But right behind him, it says, "And in his estate shall stand up a vile person." Now, this is the person who is going to do the things that this prophecy is talking about in the end time. "And in his estate shall stand up a vile person, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries." Now, commentaries mention about this particular passage that this person is not a rightful heir. This, in its original fulfillment, was referring to Antiochus IV, who is known as Antiochus Epiphanes. The word Epiphanes means God manifest. He took control in Palestine and abolished the law. He abolished the ceremonial functions, which reaction to that caused the rise of the Maccabees and a decades-long struggle. Verse 22, "And with the arms of a flood shall they be overflown from before him, and he shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant." First reference to a covenant. "And after the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully. For he shall come up and shall become strong with a small people." Can we picture a circumstance where something like that could happen? Where a particular party works deceitfully and becomes strong, in other words, take over with a relatively small percentage of the population. That's what this is telling us. He shall enter peaceably, even upon the fattest places of the province, and he shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. He shall scatter among them the prey and the spoil and the riches. Yea, and he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds, even for a time. Now, one could make a comparison with a similar passage in Revelation. I won't take the time to do that. But verse 24 sounds very much like the conduct of the beast power in the time of the end. Verse 25, and he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south. And here we begin to see that back and forth rivalry raising itself up again in the end time. Who is the king of the south? Who is the king of the north? We'll read a little bit about that as we get further down here. But he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army. But he shall not stand, for they shall forecast devices against him. Yea, they that feed of the portion of his meat shall destroy him, and his army shall overflow, and many shall fall down slain. This is the first round of battles between these two world powers. Now, verse 27. And both these kings' hearts, in other words, there's going to be a battle, there's going to be major casualties, but not necessarily a victory or a conquest, because now these two powers are going to enter into some kind of peace treaty. And both of these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief. In other words, they're going to be deceitful towards one another. And they shall speak lies at one table, but it shall not prosper. For yet the end shall be at the time appointed. Now that statement in verse 27 is, I think, very interesting. I think it's a key to tell us that by the time we get into this narrative, the old historic fulfillment has faded from the scene, and we are now fully into the end time application. Now this is talking about the end, which is at a time appointed. And also at this point in time, we're not talking about the covenant anymore. We're talking about what is called the Holy Covenant. There's also a shift there. Verse 28, then shall he return into his land with great riches, and his heart shall be against the holy covenant. And he shall do exploits and return to his own land. Verse 28, when you stand back and just consider the statement that it's making, it sort of gives us a happily ever after type of ending to the story. And his heart shall be against the Holy Covenant, and he shall do exploits and return to his own land. End of story. For him, but not for the future. Verse 29, now we know we're fully into the modern fulfillment. Verse 29, at the time appointed, something has determined a time progression. Something has said there's a time appointed for this to happen. At the time appointed, he shall return and come towards the south. And the next phrase is very interesting. But it shall not be as the former or as the latter. Is this telling us that the locales and the players and the outcomes are not identical with their original fulfillments? Is this telling us we shouldn't be looking for the same exact players as before? We shouldn't be looking for the same exact combines of nations as before. There's a break. This is no longer the Ptolemies against the Seleucids. The combine of nations that now comprises the king of the north and the combine of nations that now comprises the king of the south are not entirely the same ones as before. This isn't now Syria versus Egypt. Different set of players at the time appointed he shall return and come towards the south, but it shall not be as the former or as the latter. He is going to initiate a campaign. This is talking about the king of the north. He's going to initiate a campaign against the king of the south. And verse 30, it says, "For the ships of Kittim shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the holy covenant. So shall he do, and he shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the holy covenant." Now think of that in a modern context. Number one, the ships of Kittim. In its day, in its first fulfillment, Kittim was a reference to Western powers. Some have said it was Cyprus. Some have said it was the islands of Greece. Some have said it was Rome. Immaterial in its modern fulfillment necessarily, but it just tells us there is a Western power who has a navy who puts an end to this fellow's campaign, and he gets miffed about it. He becomes very angry, and he begins to work politically behind the scenes to fix his problem. Now you'll notice in his next incursion against the king of the south, that navy is gone from the scene. Is this telling us that this is the point in time when the pride of our power is broken? When the Western Navy, who has interests in the Middle East primarily because of oil resources, is this telling us that we have that point in time when our power is going to be negated? And I would suggest not necessarily by conquest, but simply by an economic situation. Because the powers in Europe have a very potent control over our Federal Reserve. I think people know that. The powers in Europe have historically influenced the economies of the world, particularly the economies that are the strongest, like ours. Could his rage against this Western Navy who stopped him from doing what he wanted to do, could his rage be to turn off, to collapse, the economy of the West? Does that give us a point in time? I'm just putting that to you as a speculation. Disagree if you need to. I'm just looking at this prophecy from its modern possibilities. I'll call them possibilities. But one thing we know, Jesus Christ said this is relevant to the very end time. So let's regard it as such. Verse 31, "And arms shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that makes desolate." So about this point in time is when he is free to do whatever he wants to do. And again, there's prophecies in Revelation that say about the same thing. But here we have a time reference as to when this abomination is going to be set up. Verse 32, "And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries. But the people that know their God shall be strong and do exploits." I'm going to come back to this central passage, verses 32 to 35 later. Let's drop down to verse 36. "And the king shall do according to his will." Nobody's going to stop him. As it says in Revelation, who is able to make war with him? With the world economy collapsed? Nobody. Because as we know, war is extremely expensive. What's an aircraft carrier cost? It's in the multiple billions. What do some of our jet fighters cost? It's astounding. I think a B-1, isn't that something like $20 billion, something like that? It's just astounding. Without money, you don't fight wars. Okay? So is there a message there? You judge. But the king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished, for that is determined shall be done. What he's telling us is this prophecy is certain. Exactly how it will play out remains to be seen. As we get closer to that glass, we will see more clearly. Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any God, for he shall magnify himself above all. But in his estate shall he honor the God of forces, and a God whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver and with precious stones and pleasant things. This individual, this system, is going to be extremely wealthy. And thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange God, whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many and shall divide the land for gain. He's going to have so much power and control that no one can stop him. He can divide up various portions of the earth to sell it to the highest bidder. And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him. And the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, with horsemen, and with many ships. And he shall enter into the glorious, into the countries, and shall overflow and pass over. Sounds like a modern army. And there is nobody to stop this invasion like the previous one. And he shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. This is basically the Jordanian area right now, which comprises the entire eastern boundary of Israel. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. So we know that Egypt is in the king of the south. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. We now know the extent of his invasion. Right up to the border of Libya, right up to the border of Ethiopia. We have basically a footprint of where the king of the south is, right there. But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. What's to his north? Russia. What's to his east? China. Tidings out of the east and north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many. And he shall plant the tabernacle of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. His end will come with the second coming. Now, what have we just read? We have 46 verses that refer to the career of one person, a person known in this time frame as the Antichrist. Not a biblical term, but it's a common term, and I think we know what it means. Let's take a quick review of some of the things we just read. That this scenario begins with a raiser of taxes, that's in verse 20. A vile, dishonorable person, not a rightful heir, will take over by flatteries and deceit, verse 21. A Middle Eastern peace treaty, some kind of a covenant, will be entered into, verse 22. He will treacherously break that covenant, and the Israeli leader will be slain, verse 22. Also, verse 22 suggests a major use of air power. Verse 6, after the king of the south is subdued, the land will be taken over deceitfully with a small force. Verse 23. He will then occupy, fortify, and militarize Palestine with his forces. Verse 24. This is unprecedented. This presence will make him the primary adversary of the king of the south conglomerate. Verse 24. The occupiers will make plans against the king of the south. Verse 25. The king of the south will be technically defeated but not occupied. Verse 25. The king of the south's own supporters will not be in full support of the king of the south and will conspire in his own defeat, verse 26. A peace conference will ensue, but neither person is trustable, verse 27. And the inevitable conflict will continue. The king of the north will return home having secured great riches, and that's the wealth of the oil-rich lands, verse 28. The king of the north will then seek to work against the religion of Israel, which at that time has a restored ceremonial system, verse 28. The king of the north will mount a second campaign against the king of the south, this time an invasion, but will be prevented, verse 29. A Western navy will prevent his plans out of consideration of gaining control over the oil, verse 30. The king of the north will then enter into the campaign mode, conspiring with those who forsake the covenant. That's in verse 30. The newly restored ceremonial religious system will be stopped, verse 31. The temple and its services will be polluted. And that is where the abomination which makes desolate is set up, verse 31. Those who conspire with him will be flattered and favored. Verses 32 through 35 are an inset. I'm going to come back to those. The king of the north will, with these developments, elevate himself above all other gods. Would that include the Muslim and the Christian gods? He will be fully militaristic, despotic beyond measure, verse 38, completely totalitarian. He will enhance the worship of a strange god. And we can read in Revelation of a religious system that is going to bolster the preeminence of a political system, which in turn is going to turn around and bolster the preeminence of the religious system. He will divide the world into ruling districts to the highest bidder, verse 39. Toward the end of his 3.5 years, the king of the south will rise against the king of the north, verse 40. And notice the Western naval presence will be gone from the scene by this time. The king of the south will be completely overwhelmed and defeated, verse 41. The land of Israel will be occupied, though Jordan will remain neutral, verse 41. He will amass great wealth from this invasion, verse 43. His occupied region will extend from Libya to Ethiopia, verse 43. Rumors of military threats from the north and east will turn his focus, verse 44. And he will place his headquarters and capital in Jerusalem, where he will meet his end, verse 45. Has God given us an amazing set of circumstances to be watching for? Do we appreciate what we have? Now, some of the details may come out differently. We don't know. We'll see them as they happen. But at least we ought to have the framework in our minds to understand these things. Jesus Christ told us to look at this prophecy. And he asked us to understand it as best we can. We're limited. But it's something that we need to take into serious account. Now, there's a section in here. I called it an inset. Because another factor is brought onto the scene. And that factor is found in verse 32. The second half of the verse. Because while this is going on, something else is going to be going on. While the Antichrist is doing his thing, it says this, "But the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. And they that understand among the people shall instruct many, yet they shall fall by the sword and by the flame, by captivity and by spoil many days. Now when they shall fall, they shall be helped with a little help. But many shall cleave to them with flatteries. And some of them of understanding shall fall to try them and to purge and to make them white, even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed. God's people, God's faithful witnesses, are going to have an opportunity at the time of the end to do exploits like we have never seen before. And that is something we need to keep in mind. The work is not over. Granted, as it says in another prophecy, our power, I think that's in Daniel 12, our power is scattered. But that doesn't mean closed down completely. Now, one thing that isn't brought into this scene in this prophecy, and we'd have to insert it by reference ourselves, the career of the two witnesses. Because they are going to occupy this final 3.5 years themselves. But perhaps the most important segment of this entire passage is the exploits of God's holy people. The work is not done. That idea that came into being after 1990 is completely bogus. But it's to be reconfigured. God's people will be strong, particularly as the Antichrist gains in power, verse 32. They shall instruct many, verse 33. They will suffer persecution and martyrdom, verse 33. They will be assisted in what they do, verse 34. They will have many followers who will shower them with flatteries, verse 34. Their experience will enhance their perfection for use in the kingdom, verse 35. This will continue right up to the time of the end, verse 35. Their power will become scattered, as Daniel 12:7 tells us. And this is referring mostly to within the 3.5 year time frame. That's the time setting of that. All of this will be occurring as the two witnesses are on scene, dominating the news cycles for 3.5 years. Can you imagine? I mean, if we're talking endlessly about this football player that had a fake girlfriend day after day, can you imagine what the news cycles are going to be saying about the two witnesses who drop a police force that comes against them? Fire calls down fire from heaven and kills them on the spot? Do you think CNN will report that? We have some amazing days ahead of us. God has given us a view that is unique. I don't think you're going to hear this in other churches. Some, to some degree. But I think I've been more specific with you today than perhaps you've ever heard on this particular subject. Not saying every detail that I gave you is correct. You'll have to judge for yourself. You'll have to see for yourself. But let the him who readeth understand.